Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 30 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg.
Worries.
Welcome to the morning show. I am Troy McDonald. Greg Berg is not in today. He will return tomorrow. Since 1982, the Land Trust Alliance has found ways to save the places people need and love the most. They do that by supporting land Welcome to the morning show. I am Troy McDonald. Greg Berg is not in today. He will return tomorrow. Since 1982, the Land Trust Alliance has found ways to save the places people need and love the most. They do that by supporting land conservation efforts across the United States. Here to talk about their current initiatives is Aaron Heskett, Director of National Regional Services for the Land Trust Alliance. As always, taking part in this month's environmental-themed episode is Nan Calvert, the Director of Education at the Seno Conservancy. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Thank you. We always enjoy being here.
Thank you.
So, Nan, let's start by talking about how you got involved with Aaron and the Land Trust Alliance.
Well, I have been involved with the Land Trust Alliance for quite a number of years because of my position with the former Kenosha Racine Land Trust. And then in 2014, the Land Trust and Seno Woodland Management Center merged because of our similar mission values and visions for the world in southeastern Wisconsin. And so my involvement with the Land Trust Alliance has continued. So the Land Trust Alliance, if you kind of think of it as a layer of umbrellas, we have our local land trusts like Seno, Kenosha Racine Land Trust, Kettle Moraine Land Trust, Caledonia Conservancy, and a whole host of other land trusts throughout Wisconsin. And then above us, we have something called Gathering Waters. And so that's our regional go-to organization. And then over that, we have the Land Trust Alliance, which is a national nonprofit organization. And specifically with regard to Aaron, the Land Trust Alliance holds webinars for people in the land trust community. And a couple of weeks ago, I partook in one that was focused on climate change and how do we as land trusts address this pressing issue. And it was absolutely fantastic, and I wanted to have Aaron on not only to talk about the Land Trust Alliance but also to talk about the climate change initiative and what it can do for communities and specifically for land trusts in their efforts to preserve land.
So let's start with you, Aaron. How did you first become involved with the Land Trust Conservancy?
Well, I first became involved with the Land Trust Alliance as the Midwest Director. I was hired in 2006, so I've been with the Land Trust Alliance for 10 and a half years now, and I managed our 13-state Midwest region, including the state of Wisconsin, all of their 46 land trusts there, 13 of which are accredited now as part of our Land Trust accreditation program, I might add. So congratulations to all 13 land trusts in Wisconsin for attaining that distinguished status. And after approximately 5 years as a Midwest director, I moved on to my current position as the Director of National and Regional Services. So I oversee our four regional programs and the work that they do on the ground to help land trusts with training, board services, as well as convening to connect land trusts to one another, to learn from one another, and to strengthen the community of land trusts regionally and nationally.
Right. And so let's kind of take a step back for people like myself who were not really familiar with what a land trust was before, looking into it. What exactly is a land trust?
So a land trust is a community-based organization that could be working at a very local level, say at a town level, multiple towns or a region, or even at a state level, or even a national level, as in the Nature Conservancy. And overall, the purpose of the land trust is to save land for public benefit, whether that's protecting land for plants and animals, or protecting an historic site, or perhaps farmland. So there are multiple reasons why land trusts protect land, but ultimately it's to make our communities healthier and to provide places for plants and animals to survive over time.
Why is that so important? Well, in this day and age of building new buildings and building taller buildings and this kind of age where it's all about the new, why should we care about preserving land or historic sites?
Well, land is important for a number of different reasons and provides a lot of different benefits to people and animals. Number one, in protecting land for food production, we can ensure that we have food security in the future and food that's closer to home and cheaper to grow and transport to our farmers markets and our grocery stores. Secondly, by protecting land, we're protecting and increasing the quality of our water, our drinking water, the water that we swim in, and the Great Lakes and in the rivers that we enjoy so much. And also, protecting land also helps to provide for clean air, as well as other benefits like providing places for people to go experience nature directly. In many cases, land trusts own nature preserves that they manage and allow public access so that children and their families have a place to go to experience nature in their backyard. Those are just a few examples of why it's important to protect land, why people value land conservation and the good work land trusts do.
What do you think the biggest misconception is about land trusts?
I think the biggest misconception is that land trusts are saving land and locking it away so that people cannot enjoy that land, when in fact the opposite is true. Much of the work that land trusts do is with private landowners to help private landowners keep their land in ownership, but limiting the development that can take place on their land and protect the conservation values that their land represents. So it actually, the land trusts actually help landowners keep land in their family for multiple generations so that they can enjoy that land, whether it's farmland or a private piece of property that has habitat for wildlife or water and wetlands. Secondly, we can also provide public access for people by protecting land, whether it's owned by a land trust, in some cases private landowners who donate their land under a conservation easement will allow others in the community to enjoy their land.
Yeah, on a local level, one of the big misconceptions that we run into quite a bit is that land trusts are the government and the government will be taking your land, and nothing can be further from the truth. We are local organizations, we're nonprofit organizations. Often we are made up of people from that very community who see a need to preserve what they know is land that you want to have around for generations to come. We certainly work with governmental entities. We work with municipalities. We write for grant monies that are provided by the state or the federal government. But we are not governmental entities.
And to touch on your point, Nan, that people fear kind of this, government takeover, of their land. A lot of people also look at land trusts and they say, well, what's the economic benefit? then, if people are just preserving it? How does that create jobs? How does that help my neighbor who needs work? So how would you answer that?
Well, we were just talking about this. This is a very common question. Why do we need to preserve land? As Aaron just said a moment ago, if you don't have clean water and you don't have clean air and you don't have good soil, you really don't have anything. And it doesn't matter how much money you have in your purse at that point. If your drinking water is contaminated, life becomes very difficult. And we can certainly look to Flint, Michigan as a current and ongoing example of that. In terms of monetary assets, certainly there are lands that have been preserved that are public access lands. Seno Conservancy has Jean McGraw Nature Preserve, and so people can go there anytime they want to and go hiking. You don't necessarily have to drive way up north to feel like you're out in the country or to feel like you're out in the wilderness. And we also help business owners preserve their land. If you think about orchardists, and other agriculturalists, they would like to see their land remain in agriculture long after they're gone, which provides a direct benefit to the community, and it also provides jobs, and it is also about food security, as Aaron said. There is tourism is involved, and certainly when land trusts are involved in education, then you can have groups of school kids coming out, you can have groups of service organizations coming out, and just the general public getting involved with what you do and enjoying this open space that's been preserved. It's really about quality of life when you get right down to it.
Yeah, and Dan's answer was great. And if I may, I'd just like to add a few reflections on your question, Troy.
Of course.
So we know that development pressures will only intensify over time, and they are. And development pressure from different quarters, whether it's residential and industrial development, or now one of the biggest threats to sprawl is energy development, so pipelines and transmission corridors, among other concerns around energy infrastructure. But for many decades, our country has created tax laws, zoning and transportation policies that fuel rapid sprawling development of our natural areas. So typical building patterns in America are driving us further and further from the center of our communities as we carve up increasingly distant fields and forests. And we're losing our connection to and the cache of valuable resources that nature provides for humans and animals. So ironically, we know that businesses place a premium on quality of life when determining where to set up shop and access the open space for recreation, wildlife viewing, and other aesthetics is often central to where a business ultimately lands, and research backs that up. The last thing I'll say is, communities that conserve land are making a wise investment. So there's clear evidence that demonstrates that protecting open space can generate real economic benefits and improve the local tax base. So $93 billion or so in economic output from local, state, and federal conservation investments annually, to be exact, supporting over 600,000 jobs with approximately $41 billion of income and salaries and wages. And that's from a study that I believe the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation produced a number of years ago. Last but not least, there's plenty of evidence and research that suggests and shows that real estate values increase in terms of proximity to open space. People value being close to and having access to natural areas, parks, trails. I know that's true in my community here in Kalamazoo, Michigan.
Right. Let's talk about, and you kind of mentioned it, some of the barriers that are playing a factor, like the Dakota Access Pipeline, some of the things that we're seeing, with the government kind of having a different agenda than maybe the Land Trust Alliance does. How do you plan on standing up to administrations who might not share the same vision that you do?
Well, first of all, land conservation is by its very nature a bipartisan issue. We had broad and sweeping support for our signature policy victory a year ago, where we made permanent with our friends in Congress the conservation easement tax incentive for landowners who want to donate their land for conservation purposes. So this is a bipartisan issue, and conservation is valued by both Republicans and Democrats. With regard to specific issues around, let's say, pipelines and transmission corridors, I think that we want to work with federal and state agencies and help land trusts understand how they can participate in permitting processes and the regulatory process so that protected lands that they have conserved and other sensitive lands can be avoided by the proposed pathways for these infrastructure projects. But let's be realistic and understand that these are very powerful entities, the energy companies, and very complex federal regulatory processes that we have to work together to navigate and do our best to mitigate potential harm to conserved lands that these projects do and will pose. So this is a very big, you know, this issue in particular is a very daunting challenge, and I think that given the nature of land conservation as a bipartisan issue, we have a seat at the table with credibility from the beginning. So we will be working with our partners over time to address that.
That's a terrific explanation, and it's true. Land conservation and quality of life really is a bipartisan issue. And so when you function within the land trust community, you meet people from all walks of life. And by the way, I think it's important for people to understand that land preservation doesn't just happen in rural areas with large open spaces.
Right. That's the first thing that I thought of, was mm-hmm. that this is something that happens in maybe northern Wisconsin. But you enlighten me to the fact that this happens in urban centers as well.
Absolutely, because, you know, when you think about open space in a even a moderately sized city, it's at such a premium. People are working very hard to save those open spaces, particularly for food production spaces, but also for habitat spaces. And there are some urban areas that actually have urban forests, so that they can have a small forestry operation and do all of the things that, you know, something like Sino Conservancy does with some of its forested areas. So land preservation isn't just for, you know, people who live in Colorado or people who live, you know, wherever, where there are wide open spaces and a big blue sky. This is for everybody.
Great. And something that the Land Trust Alliance mentions is that there is a direct correlation between conserving land and health. Can we touch on that, Aaron, about the correlation between health and land?
Yeah, so I'd be happy to. And open space, writ large, promotes healthy lifestyles and public recreation, which, if you think about it intuitively, can reduce, for instance, the obesity epidemic and the rising cost of healthcare in this country by getting people out on the land and active. In fact, there's a rising trend among doctors across this country that in some cases prescribe to their patients a certain regimen of time that they spend outdoors walking and just being outside and moving their bodies, which have a huge impact on public health and personal health. So today, for instance, there are more than two-thirds of our American adults in this country, and almost one-third of American children are overweight or obese. much of which, as we know, is attributed to sedentary lifestyles that the majority of Americans lead. So with annual healthcare costs soaring, and I think annual healthcare costs are now north of $2 trillion, the creation of an access to nearby parks, trails, and natural areas that land trusts are responsible for protecting, municipalities, states, and our federal government. It's one of the most cost-effective ways to stem the epidemic of the biggest health crises that we're facing: obesity, diabetes, and heart disease. And to put a finer point on this, the outdoor recreation industry on open lands creates thousands of jobs and millions, if not billions, of dollars in consumer spending and generates tax revenues for local and state economies. So,
yeah, it's so true. And not only does it make life worth living from a physical standpoint, it's also essential for human beings' mental health to be able to get out there and feel something green, to see something green, to hear the wind and the water, to hear birds. The vast majority of people need that as a balance to the rest of their lives, because we're not really meant to live indoors all of the time, surrounded by concrete and automobile exhaust and lots of noise and all those kinds of things. So that's why people say when they come to a beautiful place, they'll say, oh my goodness, it's so spiritual, or it's so rejuvenating, it's so restorative. There have been so many studies about the benefit people glean from open space with regard to their mental health.
You know, of course, all of this, you know, really kind of lays the groundwork for what the Land Trust Alliance is doing now with this brand new NAN. You came in and your face was glowing. You were so excited about the climate change initiative, which is addressing some of the concerns that people may have out there. So, Aaron, let's talk about all of your years since 1982, all of your years of experience now leading to this climate change initiative.
I'd be happy to, Troy. And, you know, I just start by saying that, you know, the Land Trust Alliance and Land Trust have been, to a certain extent, working to address climate change and concerned about its effects on our natural resources, wildlife, our human communities, for years. And the Land Trust Alliance has been involved directly in climate change work since about 2004. But, you know, I think we're at a point in the history of, the history of the environmental movement, but we're at a point in where we are globally and the impacts that humans are having on this planet, where the Land Trust Alliance made the decision that we really needed to take a bold step forward and provide a program and initiative with resources for our land trust members to help them adapt to and mitigate climate change. And this looks maybe slightly different depending on where you are across the country. Our 1,000 land trust members vary in size, they vary in their the focus of their mission, they work in various political and cultural environments, you know, so I think it's just important to recognize that this is a dynamic program. So I will say that, provide a quick overview of what we've envisioned here, if that's good with you, Troy.
Absolutely.
So I think top line is it's getting very late. We have between 5 and 15 years. You know, over the next 5 to 15 years, those are really the critical years for action if we want to stave the worst impacts of climate change and keep the Earth from warming more than 2 degrees Celsius above baseline, essentially, when temperature recordings were first begun.
Wow, I did not know that.
In the 1800s.
I did not know that. 5 to 10 years? If people knew that, they'd be freaking out.
Five to 15 years. By 2030, we better be on the right track.
Wow.
With climate action globally. So the question for the global community is how to close that ambition gap, as you allude to, Troy, and saying, wow, I didn't know we had that much time. It is ambitious, but we can do it. It's not whether to act. So the land conservation community has a really critical role to play here. And recognizing that, that land trust can contribute to combating climate change, we launched a new initiative called the Land Trust Climate Change Initiative. It's a $2 million four-year initiative to help land trusts address climate change. It's funded by a generous Catalyst grant from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation. And this is a new program that will provide land trusts with strategies, training, and tools that they need to incorporate climate planning, adaptation, and mitigation practices into their work. And so we have three principal strategies that we're pursuing here to help bolster and strengthen the land trust community in this arena. The first is we are aiming to help land trusts incorporate climate science into their planning for land acquisition and management and stewardship of land to address climate impacts and promote resilience of that land over time. And principally, we're going to be using the Nature Conservancy's science that they've developed called Conserving Nature Stage, which identifies places in the landscape that will provide refugia for plants and animals to survive the worst impacts of climate change over time. The second strategy we're pursuing is really to promote the use of vegetation and land, including soils, to absorb and store carbon, so carbon sequestration, if you will. And we are doing this as we currently we're developing a partnership with the Nature Conservancy and government partners and others to help promote the concept that natural climate solutions such as absorption of carbon in soils, grasslands, wetlands, and other vegetation is a key and important part of a climate solution. In fact, the recent research by the Nature Conservancy has shown, and this will be published soon, later in the year, I should say, nature can mitigate about 25% of the emissions that we need to capture to meet the 2 degrees Celsius cap, while at the same time providing sustainable livelihoods, clean water, greater protection from floods and storms, healthy soils for food production. And land trusts have, they're already doing this, right? They're saving land, they're stewarding it. They are a natural partner in this effort to promote natural climate solutions as they're doing their work on an ongoing basis, perhaps with some changes of focus and maybe techniques. But this is sort of a natural space in which land trusts are already operating. So we're also working to help land trusts participate in the carbon offset market, primarily through the California Cap and Trade Program, to help them access revenue that they may be able to obtain by selling carbon offsets to regulated entities in the California Cap and Trade Program, and all the while continue to protect, in particular, forest land, working forest land, as part of their mission. And then the last part of this strategy is we want to help shape, to the extent that we can, federal policies that provide incentives, financing, and other programs, technical programs, that affect private landowners to to help them, in particular farmers, manage their land to maximize greenhouse gas benefits. So last thing is the third strategy, which is given the acceleration of renewable energy development, and there are now 37 states across the country that have a clean energy mandate, fairly aggressive at that. So New York, for instance, has a mandate to secure 50% of its energy needs from renewable sources by 2030. But we want to work with these state legislatures and the developers and empower land trusts to encourage the development of renewable energy in a way that avoids sensitive lands and minimizes habitat fragmentation. So to really start this process, we're pursuing a pilot project in New York as part of a larger stakeholder roundtable led by the Nature Conservancy and the Alliance for Clean Energy New York to help try and shape New York state policy and guidelines related to renewable energy siting. And ultimately, we hope the outcomes from that pilot, which we're deep into this year, will help land trusts in other states like Wisconsin effectively navigate similar challenges. So I'll stop there. I'm sorry for the long wind, but that's sort of the framework that our new initiative is pursuing.
Right. No, and that's great because people can really sense your passion about the issue. So that's great. People really do need to hear this, but there are those who don't want to hear this, the climate change deniers. How do you articulate your message in a way that reaches them, or are you not even trying to reach them? Are you just trying to focus on those who will join this initiative?
Well, this initiative is focused on helping land trusts build their capacity to respond to climate impacts. But I will say that, based on the research that the Yale Program on Climate Change Communication has done, you may be familiar with it. It's called the Global Warming Six Americas, and they've been working since 2008 to measure public perception of global warming. And I think it's important to note from this research, all research is flawed to some extent, but this is seminal work and unique. And what they've shown is that 7 in 10 Americans think global warming is happening. And by contrast, only about 1 in 8 Americans think global warming is not happening. And that's not to say that the way that climate change, even spoken as a word, resonates the same everywhere, because it doesn't, especially in certain parts of the country like the Great Plains farming states, right? The politically conservative area where climate change is not a welcome word. But I think that what we're trying to achieve here is helping land trusts work with their constituents and landowners of all walks of life, of all stripes, of all political persuasions, and help them protect their land and resources from the inevitable increase in extreme weather events, droughts, major storm events, floods, that are already happening and that farmers are already starting to adjust to and recognize as an example of how we can appeal to and work with constituents from different walks of life and with different belief systems.
Nan, I do kind of have a question for you as you run. You're familiar with the land trusts here in this area. Mm-hmm. How do you deal with people who you interact with who might not understand climate change? Have you faced a lot of those issues here? Because we are in Wisconsin. The state voted, for conservative principles this mm-hmm. past election. What are you facing?
A lot of times it's an educational gap. So you have to start at the very beginning and explain that weather and climate are two completely different things. And then once people begin to understand that, even if they don't believe that climate change has been caused by human action, most often you can get them to realize that we have more extreme weather than we used to, and we have more incidents of extreme weather than we used to. And especially people who've lived in Wisconsin for a long time, they say, where has my snow gone? Where is winter? What's happening here?
I was just going to say that this year has been crazy.
Mm-hmm, right. So patterns have definitely changed. And even for people who are the strongest doubters or the strongest deniers, you can often achieve some common ground by saying, but, you know, look, if we preserve this, if we enhance this, if we focus on species conservation, water quality issues, and so forth, it benefits everybody. There's not a downside to it. And hopefully you can find some alignment there. Hopefully they can find something that motivates them to support this kind of thing. There are always going to be people who will work against it. And you have to sometimes just let that go. But there are lots of people who want to work with you and set things up for success in the future. It's difficult for people. Sorry, Aaron, go ahead.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Finish your thought, man.
It's difficult for people to understand the urgency. It's been urgent for a long time.
Right, we heard that number earlier, 5 to 15 years. I did not know that. That's not being really talked about.
No, it's an extremely pressing problem, and we have to get on board with this. We have to work very hard to put in place all of the buffers that we can in order to lessen and forestall the effects of climate change. I mean, if you look at California, they've gone from drought to not being able to use much water at all because they just don't have it, and now they're experiencing terrible floods. And unfortunately, because the landscape has changed so dramatically all over our country, you know, wetlands have been removed, we've flattened the landscape, native plants have been replaced by non-native plants and invasive species, you don't have those buffer systems to help you anymore. But working with your local land trust, you can help get those things back in place. And that's the beauty of having a land trust. You know, people say, I don't know what to support anymore. I don't know what to do about, you know, endangered species. I don't know what to do about invasive plants. I don't know what to do about topsoil loss. If you support your local land trust, if you support Gathering Waters, if you support the Land Trust Alliance, you can take care of all of those things because everything is connected, and that's what we're working toward.
And I would just add to this great explanation by Nan that, you know, this, to your question, Troy, it all really comes back to what unifies people. Clean air, clean water, healthy soils and places to grow healthy food, and helping farmers be successful in their farming operations. It's about connecting the dots through relatable, observable phenomena, if you will. So weather events, right? Weather and climate, there is a relationship. We're seeing increases in precipitation, changes in precipitation patterns, drought, extreme precipitation events. And by talking about what's happening that people are observing and responding to those things through solution-based action, I think we can find unity and common ground there.
Mm-hmm. And I think I just want to interject, you know, here in Wisconsin, we have a real-life example of a farmer who is completely engaged, and he awakened to this problem a long time ago, and we've actually had him on the radio here. He's Mark Shepherd. So if you don't know Mark Shepherd, you need to look him up. He's been doing all kinds of things that enhance the quality of water, enhance the quality of soil, using a combination of local edible foodstuffs, permaculture. He also has he grows. I mean, it's just amazing. I could go on and on about it. But if you don't know who Mark Shepherd is, he's internationally known, and he's a fantastic example of what can be done from an agricultural standpoint.
and we're kind of wrapping up here, closing out the program. If people want to get involved, and you were kind of mentioning it, ways that they can, what are the ways that people can get involved? Not everyone owns land,
no.
But how can they support? Let's talk from the landowner's perspective and from people who just have heard this today and want to do something.
If you are a landowner and you want to leave a legacy, not only for your family, but for generations to come, all you have to do is contact your local land trust, and they can help you begin that process. You can contact Sino Conservancy if you're in Racine and Kenosha counties. And all land trusts work within a certain boundary lines. And so I can certainly point you in the right direction. If you'd like to get involved with Sino Conservancy, just give me a call or shoot me an email. There are all kinds of things you can do. We have all kinds of classes and events and fun things, and it all goes to support education and land preservation. Go to the Land Trust Alliance website. Read about the climate change initiative. Find out what's going on a national level. They do the heavy lifting for us on a national level. They're the experts in this sort of thing. So, there are so many different ways to get involved. And it doesn't just mean throwing money at it, that you have skills and talents and time, and those are just as needed and just as valuable as a contribution.
Thank you so much, both of you, Nan Calvert and Aaron Heskett. Thank you for being here.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Nan, you always close the show with announcements, so let's hear them.
There are so many important things going on. March 18th, mark your calendar, 9 in the morning until 1 p.m. will mark the date for EcoFest Racine. It will be held in the Racine campus of Gateway Technical College in the Lake Building. Admission is free. Every family gets a gift. It will feature displays, ask an expert room, cooking demonstration, kids activities, all kinds of things. It'll be a really fun thing to do, March 18th. EcoFest Racine. Hawthorne Hollow is in the midst of its maple sugaring class. It continues March 18th and March 25th, and it runs from 10 a.m. to noon. Not to be outdone, Riverbend Nature Center has sugar and off pancake breakfast March 12th and March 19th, 9 to 1 p.m. You can go for a hike in the sugar bush. They've tapped over 70 maple trees. You can see them cooking off maple sap and turning it into maple syrup. Mm. Really fun and delicious thing to do. And finally, Hoy Audubon, our local Audubon chapter, is having a field trip to look for a waterfowl near Eagle Lake. That will happen by meeting this weekend at the Highway 20 and I-94 Park and Ride, and then you'll carpool to the site. You've got to be there by 8 a.m.
Thank you so much, Nan.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening, and have a wonderful rest of your day. This is The Morning Show.
Hearing, and we think that's some.
Tomorrow on the morning show, you're going to be hearing a very, very interesting conversation, not only with Gateway Technical College President Brian Albrecht, but with two representatives of Gateway's outstanding nursing program, Ann Wilkinson, who is interim dean of nursing, and Vicki Hulbeck, who is part of the nursing faculty and a recent recipient of the President's Faculty Excellence Award. The primary focus of our conversation tomorrow will be a conversation about Gateway's new Human Patient Simulation Center. Here's just a little excerpt of that conversation with Vicki Hulbeck, explaining what all the excitement is about and what is meant by a human patient simulator.
We use the human patient simulator, first of all, is it's a mannequin, it's a robot that actually responds physiologically. So in that, this is a mannequin who has pulses, who has a heart rate, who has lung sounds, bowel sounds. We have Lucy, the childbirth simulator, who gives birth to a breech. A breech delivery, a vaginal delivery. She also can have a postpartum hemorrhage of up to 2 liters of blood-tinged fluid. These are mannequins that we can talk into a microphone and it comes out of their head. So it looks as if you're talking to them.
Wow. I mean, or so it seems like they're talking to you.
They're talking to you.
Wow.
It's scary at first, but after a while you get used to it because they'll blink at you and they'll let you know whether or not it hurts. And
you just never know when you might walk in and have a childbirth occurring.
Wow. Holy cow. And so for instance, with Lucy, you can determine today she's going to give birth this way and she's going to experience this potential problem.
Absolutely.
And then the nursing student working on Lucy has to contend with it then.
It's an experiential learning environment so that we can provide a learning experience that may not be available in clinical. I can have a student assigned to a labor patient all day for 12 hours and she may not give birth. Hmm. But Lucy, she will always deliver.
Vicki Hulbeck from the nursing faculty here at Gateway Technical College. That's a brief excerpt from what I promise you is a fascinating conversation about Gateway's nursing program and the new Human Patient Simulation Center, which begins construction sometime next week. So that's tomorrow's morning show, just after 8 o'clock. I want to tell you about some other morning shows that are coming up. And first, let me say again, thank you to my colleague, Troy McDonald, for assisting with today's morning show, which I hope you enjoyed. On Monday, I hope you can listen to my conversation with Lawrence Levy. He is past chief financial officer for Pixar. And Pixar, of course, is that extraordinary film company that has given the world such groundbreaking works as Toy Story and its two sequels, Monsters, Inc., WALL-E, and many, many other marvelous, marvelous films. Lawrence Levy was instrumental in helping take Pixar sort of from its small, humble beginnings as a startup to its place of preeminence in the business. Although he was not part of the creative wing, but rather the administrative and financial wing of the company. But the story is a fascinating one. And his memoir about his experience at Pixar is called To Pixar and Beyond. And you'll hear my conversation with him on Monday. On Tuesday, Dr. James Kinchin joins me from the University of Wisconsin Parkside. Among other guests that we are expecting next week, on Thursday, Dr. Art Sear from Carthage College paying his monthly visit to the program. And a week from tomorrow, I'm excited to replay two of my very favorite interviews from all the way back in 2005. One of them, Dale Mahardy, author of a book called Denison, Iowa, Searching for the Soul of America Through the Secrets of a Midwestern Town. This is one of the best books I've ever read on small-town America. And, of course, with the recent surprising results of the most recent presidential election, many experts are trying to come to grips with what's going on in small-town America and what are the people who live in small towns across the country thinking and feeling about their own country. And this book is a really interesting set of insights into that. Also, I'll be replaying my interview with Then We Set His Hair on Fire, insights and accounts from a Hall of Fame career in advertising by Phil Dusenberry, who had important